beach and later on a people's park. The winds of change fanning the flames, student demonstration sparks. Down to Alabista where police felt so harassed. They called the special riot squad in the LA County Sheriff, and there was a riot going on.
Hey there, ladies and gentlemen. It's Rick Spezak, News Director, Progressive News Network. Welcome. Welcome once again. Tonight we've got some wonderful guests. We've got Mark Pafford from the Florida Legislature, Democratic Policy Chair. We've got Luis Cuevas, a Progressive Push. We've got Steve Horn. He's a fellow with the Smog Blog, also writes for Fire Dog Lake and Huffington Post. And we've got Alan Mackey, a union organizer and activists from the upper Midwest. So now the news. U.S. Environmental Protection Agency and Duke Energy reached a deal Thursday afternoon to clean up one of the largest coal ash spills in United States history. The deal comes after months of advocates demanding answers and residents calling for stricter enforcement as a result of Duke spilling thousands of tons of coal ash into the Dan River near Eden, North Carolina in February. The EPA decided that a company must perform a comprehensive assessment, determine the location of coal ash deposits, remove deposits along the Dan River as deemed appropriate by the EPA in consultation with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. EPA will work with Duke Energy to ensure that cleanup at the site and affected areas is comprehensive based on sound scientific and ecological principles, that it complies with all federal and state environmental standards, and moves as quickly as possible, EPA Regional Administrator Heather McTeer-Tony said in a statement. Protection of public health and safety remains a priority concern, along with the long-term ecological health of the Dan River. The decision will leave Duke on the hook financially too. The company will be required to reimburse the EPA for its time and oversight costs during the cleanup. The order also requires Duke to reimburse all past EPA response costs along with future oversight costs in connection with the spill. The spill began on February 2nd when a stormwater pipe broke underneath the 27-acre primary pond and drained to the Dan River. Although state regulators and Duke Energy scrambled to get the spill under control, they waited more than 24 hours before notifying the public of the spill on Monday evening. By then, an estimated 82,000 tons of coal ash and 27 million gallons of contaminated water had dumped into the Dan River, a public drinking water supply for downstream communities like Danville, Virginia. More than 48 hours after the spill was discovered, thick, dark gray, toxic coal ash sludge continued to flow out of the pipe and into the river. Hey, it's Geithner versus Warren in a battle of the bailout. This is from Marilyn Giewax from National Public Radio, May 25th. Financial crisis of 2008 caused such an enormous upheaval that future historians will long be asking who caused it, who fixed it, and could it have turned out better. Recently, two key players looked back. Former Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner wrote Stress Test, Reflections on Financial Crisis, and Senators Elizabeth Warren wrote A Fighting Chance. The two reached opposite conclusions. Geithner believes the bank bailout proved its worth. Warren remains outraged that wealthy bankers have not been jailed. So should the financial system rescuers get our thanks for preventing a second Great Depression or our disdain for allowing a heist to go unpunished? Let's look at the fantasy debate that Geithner and Warren might have using words from their books. At the end, please vote for the winner. But at first, there's a little background on our debaters. Each chose to build a career around public service rather than personal wealth. Warren started out as an attorney. She might have joined the high-priced law firm, but instead became a professor studying the impact of bankruptcy laws on the poor and the middle class. Geithner had opportunities to make windfalls on Wall Street. Instead, he chose to earn a salary at a public institution such as the International Monetary Fund, the Treasury Department, and the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. In November of 2008, when the crisis was at its white-hot peak, their career paths crossed in Washington. Geithner was preparing to become Treasury Secretary, and Warren was assuming her role as chairwoman of the Congressional Oversight Panel to watch over TARP, the Troubled Asset Relief Program. Congress had just passed the $700 billion package to shore up the crumbling bank system. Geithner explains the mindset he was in as he headed to Congress to beg for TARP's passage. Geithner: the world was burning. What more was there to discuss? This was not the time to focus on punishing the arsonists. This was time to focus on putting out the fires. And as long as TARP could be used to recapitalize the system, I just wanted Congress to pass it as fast as possible. Warren said it was wrong to focus on keeping the banks whole rather than on helping the millions of workers who were losing their jobs and their homes. Warren: as soon as TARP was set up, tens of billions of dollars started to flow to the giant banks, but that didn't keep credit flowing to the small businesses, and more of them were shutting down. And at the same time, the tide of foreclosures just kept rising. TARP seemed to be doing precious little for small businesses or families in trouble. Geithner often compares the events of late 2008 to war, wildfires, and crashing planes. He says taking focus away from implementing TARP to mete out punishment would have been foolish. A lot of firms that didn't deserve saving needed to be saved. That's because nothing is more dangerous during a panic than the sudden liquidation of a major institution. Even if we couldn't prevent an ugly crash, I wanted to explore ways to put foam on the runway, anything to mitigate the damage. Warren was appalled by Geithner's references to foam. The Treasury foreclosures, she might say, and she wrote in her book, were intended to foam the runway to protect against a crash landing by the banks. Millions of people were getting tossed out in the street, but the Secretary of the Treasury believes the government's most important role was to provide a soft landing for the tender fannies of the banks. Oh, Lord. Geithner says homeowners and workers gain much more by having the financial system stabilized than they would have by spending time on prosecuting bankers. The Old Testament vengeance appeals to the populist fury of the moment, but the truly moral thing to do during a raging financial inferno is to put it out. The goal should be to protect the innocent, even if some of the arsonists escape their full measure of justice. Full measure? How about any? Warren doesn't buy it. No perp walks, no mass indictments. Where are the armies of auditors seizing hard drives and poring over financial statements? Geithner says he can understand his critics' indignation, but they can't appreciate the terror he felt while staring into a financial system abyss. The overwhelming burden of responsibility combined with a paralyzing risk of catastrophic failure, the frustration about stuff out of your control, the uncertainty about what would help, the knowledge that even good decisions might turn out badly, the pain and guilt of neglecting your family, the loneliness, the numbness. Looking back, Geithner felt validated. Banks repaid their bailout money. Depositors did not stage bank runs. The economy began growing in the summer of 2009, and Congress passed a sweeping financial reform package. Our unemployment rose to 10%. But not to 25 as in the Depression. The stock market has exceeded its pre-crisis peak, so retirement funds that lost $5 trillion during the crisis have gained it back. Warren concedes that the bailout did not become a financial catastrophe, but said the bankers learned only that they can be reckless without risk. The government eventually recovered the money it put into Citibank and the other banking giants, but at the time those deals were struck, no one knew what the future held, and all risks were on the taxpayers. And the rewards had turned out to be meager for most, she said. The American people were told the bailout would make it possible for banks to start lending to small business again and to help relieve the foreclosure crisis. But once those no-strings-attached checks were distributed to the big banks, that promise evaporated like a tiny ice cube in the desert. So now, each of these key figures has made a case. You decide who was more persuasive. You can drop us a note and tell us what you think. How would we write and fight? This is from Andre Vilcek. Why are the streets of New York, Washington, D.C., London, and Paris so orderly, so quiet? Are we, the opposition, investigative journalists, philosophers, documentary filmmakers, doing such a terrible job? Are we not providing North America and the European public enough information, enough proof about the monstrous state of the world, enough so that they, citizens of the empire, finally get through thoroughly pissed off, detach their backsides from their couches, chairs, and flood the capital and business centers with their bodies, demanding change, demanding an end to atrocities that are being committed all over the world, the end of this imperialist and neocon madness? Point of no return 300. Are we failing squarely and patiently to give examples and proof of the pain this world is suffering because of the market fundamentalists, because of unchecked neocolonialism and shameless Western supremacy? Are we not providing enough stories, enough images, enough focus to convince the citizens of the countries we are ruling that something has gone awfully wrong? Well, how do you answer that question? If you do, If you believe we're doing a good job, please support us and other progressive broadcasters. I want to mention my colleagues, Gwen Holden Berry and her show, Here Be Monsters, Anita Stewart and her show. We also want to mention Brian Stetton and his Progress Toward Democracy, Susan Nylon and the Nylon Report, and many others. It's stunning to consider whether we've come from democracy to plutocracy. This is a story in the op-ed news called Peasants for Plutocracy. In what kind of country is money considered free speech? In what kind of country is a legal construct considered a person? It's definitely not a country to which one would apply the term democracy. It's stunning to consider where we've come from democracy to plutocracy. The ruling by the Supreme Court on April 2, 2014, McCutcheon versus FEC, was one of the most egregious blows to democracy that our country has ever seen. Certainly, previous rulings, such as Citizens United versus FEC, set up the current ruling. The Supreme Court ruled in McCutcheon versus FEC that there could be no overall contribution limits, that an individual could donate to campaigns, whereas in Citizens United versus FEC, the court ruled that there could be no limits on how much an entity could give to any campaign. Those entities, including organizations such as corporations, lobbies, and labor unions, both of the Supreme Court decisions link back to a 1976 Supreme Court decision of Buckley versus Valeo, in which the court effectively ruled that money equals free speech. This was a challenge to an amendment to the 1971 law that created the FEC, the Federal Election Commission. The Federal Election Commission Campaign Act, FECA, was aimed at controlling campaign funding. The unpublic voices. When you combine the money equals free speech decision and evisceration of all attempts to control unlimited funding of campaigns with the concept of corporate personhood, a legal scenario emerges that is truly frightening. This is particularly true if one is operating within a democracy. Effectively, what's been crafted is a complete handover of our political structure to those who have the most money to buy it. In other words, the United States has moved from a society which was a punitive representative democracy, eligible citizens selecting representatives to be decision makers, to a plutocracy, a rule by the rich. The Republicans used to like to remind us that the U.S. is a republic, thereby reinforcing the concept that it's not a true free democracy. This becomes increasingly important as the context around who is part of the public and who represents shift. Certainly a significant part of the overall strategy of moving the United States away from a representative democracy with broad public citizens as voters and a different form of republic where the rich and the corporations are the voting public. It's about who defines who gets to vote. This goes directly to the attack on broad enfranchisement of voters. The process of disenfranchisement is taking three primary paths. Gerrymandering. The gerrymandering of districts to weaken the voting power of those who traditionally do not vote Republican, poor and working class people, people of color, and traditional Democratic districts. This had its largest public airing with the Texas 11, who fled to New Mexico for 46 days in 2003 to block a redistricting vote placed on the Texas floor by Republicans. Recrafting voting rights through various mechanisms involving combination of voter ID and the purging of voter rolls, and at the federal level, the undermining of the Voting Rights Act, we can once again thank the Supreme Court for eviscerating that act of Constitution. Promulgating the idea that voting is meaningless and big government overrides the people's needs. This strategy has been used to shrink the voting population, and the smaller the population, the smaller a voting bloc one needs to push forward your own agenda. This also nicely sets up the idea of shrinking government in almost all forms and privatizing or corporatizing its functions. SCOTUS and the corporations. The Roberts Court is argued to be the most corporate court since at least World War II, Epstein et al. Versus Minnesota Law Review. How business fares in the Supreme Court. Various protections are offered to corporations, but essentially isolate and protect them from virtually any claim or harm. So not only are corporations being argued to be corporate persons within the constitutional sense of the law, but they are increasingly becoming inviolate in that personhood. Those rulings include, according to Brent Kendall of the Wall Street Journal, Supreme Court comes to the defense of business. The Supreme Court ruled this session that Comcast subscribers alleging anti-competitive practices couldn't proceed as a class action because there was no way to determine monetary damage. Royal Dutch Shell allegations that Shell was complicit in human rights violations overseas couldn't be tried in U.S. court. American Express, a class action suit over card fees, couldn't proceed because the merchants were bound by a contract they had signed with the card issuer. And who are the perpetual players in this death democracy of democracy? Who are they? Why, none other than hiding in plain sight, ubiquitous in virtually every town and city, the Chamber of Commerce. Yes, this friendly, welcome to our town, bring on the conventions, here's your visitor map, are truly the hide within the Dr. Jekyll. The Chamber of Commerce has been behind many of the cases before the Supreme Court, expanding corporate rights and protections, and they're also pushing conservative and pro-business legislation in every state of the union. See ALEC Exposed. And according to a study, How Business Fares in the Supreme Court by Lee F. Stein, William Landis, and Richard Posner in the Minnesota Law Review, volume 97. This they call the golden age of thought crime. Indeed, indeed. America has elevated shooting rampages to the level of sacred religious right. And the only proof that's needed to prove the contention is an article in the Wall Street Journal that asserts the media is doing exactly opposite of what psychologists said they should be doing when the new instance of shooting strangers has become a celebrity, unfolds on the cable news networks and the big network evening game shows. News shows. That's right. News shows, game shows, what's the difference? The Armstrong and Getty radio show invited listeners to go to their website to get a link to the story. It's a remarkable coincidence that their show in the San Francisco Bay Area is preceded on a Fox radio station by the Wall Street Journal show. Isn't it ironic to note that the last week of May 2014, in the land famous for freedom of speech, the hot topic was arguing over what can and cannot be said about a wide variety of topics. Is there anything about the shooting that hasn't been said? Reading How to Talk Dirty and Influence People, we couldn't help but imagine that if Lenny Bruce were still alive, he would find a way to say something that would offend both liberals and conservatives, such as, is it too difficult to imagine that Bruce would, in an attempt to elevate the debate to a new level of vitriol, by saying, well, if prostitution was legal in California, the victim would still be alive? Is it difficult to imagine Bruce noting that if a good-looking young man driving a Mercedes can't get laid, then America has become a sick nation indeed? A Wednesday edition of the Getty and Armstrong show included one of the sidekicks telling a personal anecdote about bypassing the waiting phase in a sushi bar, and when the fellow was asked to explain why he got preferential treatment, responded, because I'm white. On Thursday morning, the radio show quickly mentioned the guy who told that story was no longer working for the show. And since Rush Limbaugh loves to goad the liberals by uttering ideas that seem perilously close to taking the concept of edgy off the deep end, hasn't conservative radio come to resemble the Chicky sequence in Rebel Without a Cause? How would liberals react if Uncle Rushbo read some old Lenny Bruce routines on his radio show? Bruce did use the N-word, and if Limbaugh read the transcript of a Lenny Bruce rant that included the use of the N-word, would liberals condemn that as a reprehensible way to sneak that on the radio show? Or would they resurrect the old freedom of speech arguments that were, was it 50 years ago, offered in defense of Lenny Bruce? The national debate over gun control has morphed into a state of stalemate. Neither side will even listen to the other team's points, and much to the grief of politicians caught in the middle, as a result, nothing will be done. Mass shootings are a very effective wedge issue, and on Wednesday, a lawmaker in California was proposing that citizens who think that a neighbor is mentally unfit to own a gun should be given veto power over any legal attempts to purchase a firearm. The concept of wedge issues to take a dispute and get a wildly exuberant political diversion going ultimately do nothing to change things, and then get on TV and explain how and why the opposition political party thwarted the will of the majority? Bill Maher said something that was deemed unacceptable by the patriotic conservatives, and he was marginalized for his attempt to think outside the box. Don Imus was discredited by a conservative news organization and then hired back by them when the value of his services fell to a much more affordable price. Coincidence? Could you have a couple extra $1 billion sitting idle and want to buy an NBA team cheap? We've been reading Death of a Pirate by Adrian Johns, which is about the phenomenon known as pirate radio, as practiced in Great Britain during the last century. The liberal point of view on publicly owned radio is as extinct as the Wolfman Jack radio show. Some time ago, the world's laziest journalist predicted that when liberal philosophy on radio becomes extinct, it would be necessary to resurrect the concept of pirate radio, and often clandestine programming being broadcast from beyond the borders, which could be heard inside the U.S. Some folks say that the Internet fills that need, but a person in a car, can they listen to a show being streamed on the Internet? Lenny Bruce got into deep trouble for talking about things like gays, blacks, and drugs. He was adamant about giving his right to free speech. And when Rush Limbaugh makes the headlines with a new outrageous quote, we wonder if Lenny Bruce will be the first to come to Rush's defense. Is freedom of speech a one-way street only for liberals? Or is it a two-way street that Bruce would endorse? Partisan punditry is just cheerleading in disguise. Seeing Lenny Bruce defend Donald Sterling's freedom of speech would be a hell of a notable example of doing a guest shot on a talk show. On Thursday, former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg caused a stir by asserting that liberals were stifling conservative teachers at Harvard. Are there more liberals condemning Rush Limbaugh for what he says than there were conservatives demanding the arrest of Lenny Bruce for what he was saying 50 years ago? Gridlock in the gun debate. Could be a symptom that freedom of speech has become moribund, and the most appropriate illustrations of this situation would be a photo of a World War I trench where the battle lines did not move while thousands died maintaining the status quo. Don't expect to see Lenny Bruce or anyone else asserting that legalized prostitution would have prevented the shootings in that Isla Vista. The main event between Hillary and Jeb is more than 2 years off now, and the thought of 2 solid years of yay for Jeb, boo for Hillary on talk shows are stifling. Doesn't America need partisan punditry and print on the air and even on the boob tube so it doesn't get to be so predictable and monotonous that folks lose interest in the election? Or is that Karl Rove's stealth game plan for the next election? NSA gathering millions of images for facial recognition technology. This is an interesting technology story. New York Times report shows that the spy agency has obtained images from social media, text messages, and email. The National Security Agency is mass collecting facial images through its surveillance programs for use in facial recognition technology. Journalists James Risen and Laura Poultris revealed Saturday in the New York Times. Secret documents exposed by NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden revealed that the spy agency views facial recognition as the next frontier of surveillance and uses new software technology to obtain facial images from digital communications, including email, social media, and even text messages. According to the report, documents from 2011 reveal the agency intercepts millions of images per day, including about 55,000 facial recognition quality images, which translate into a tremendous untapped potential. One internal NSA document dated 2010, now let's see, if I count on my fingers, that's 4 years ago. It's not just traditional communications we're after. It's taking a full arsenal approach that digitally exploits the clues a target leaves behind in their regular activities on the net to compile biographic and biometric information that can help implement precise precision targeting. According to the report, the NSA accelerated its use of facial recognition technology under the Obama administration. It's not immediately clear how many people have had their images intercepted by the NSA, according to this report. However, the agency is not only the only one using this new technology. The report notes that the FBI, state and local police, the State Department, and the Department of Homeland Security are also increasingly turning to facial recognition programs. How about that? Well, there's more news available, more questions we wanted to raise. And so if you go to averyvoice.com, that's A-V-E-R-Y, Avery Voice, V-O-I-C-E.com, you'll be able to hear this and other stories that we wanted to bring to your attention. So please check it out. Okay, next up, we had a wonderful interview with Mark Pafford, who gave us his assessment of the recently completed Florida legislative session. And it's something that you definitely should hear. It's his perspective on the legislative session that just completed. And here he is, Mark Pafford. Mr. Pafford, sir, welcome.
Hi there, and I'm unmuted, I promise.
Okay, great. Good start. How you doing, Mark?
And this is the first time... I'm doing very well. This is one of the first times I'm actually using a landline, so I'm hoping throughout the entire interview we have a really good connection. And if all else fails, I've built a fire so we can have smoke signals.
Okay, that's great. And the carrier pigeon should be there any minute.
Absolutely.
We at least have a chance to talk because, of course, the full weight of the end of net neutrality hasn't hit us yet. But that's a story for another time.
Sir, I want to thank you for the wonderful work you've done in this legislative session, and I want you to kind of give us your overview, sir, on the good, the bad, and the ugly of this past legislative session.
I am available. Fire away.
First things first, if you were to say, many people believe that even though Democrats are in the minority, we have a stronger hand. We've had a stronger hand this year than we've had in the past for some time. Would you say that's a true assessment, sir?
Repeat that one more time. I want to make sure.
What I said was
that
Democrats, even though we're still in the minority in the legislature, we've had a stronger hand, and we've been able to fight back more effectively and make a little more forward progress. Is that the way you see it?
You know, I mean, certainly I think the optics of the situation would appear that way this year. However, you know, I would differ a little bit. I think, you know, we're really outnumbered heavily, both in the House and the Senate, and certainly the governor has shown no interest in some of the basic things that, you know, as far as the Democratic members, our side of things, you know, hold any special interest or priority for him. I think if there were any advantages this year, it would be that, you know, you have a governor who basically does not have a Republican primary, nor does he have, you know, a Tea Party type of agenda because of that. And so he's been able to dive a little bit to the middle to basically help his reelection campaign in November. And so, you know, I think the optics may suggest what you say, but I think the reality is actually motivated. It's rooted in something else. And, you know, we can get into some of the details, but I'll stop there and keep asking.
There has been a lot of grassroots energy and concern about our many and various water quality issues. And as we saw, the legislature was prepared to declare that off the table. No discussion whatsoever, and they postponed it, they say, until the next leadership comes in the legislature. What did it look like there on the ground? Is this something that the Republicans felt that they can just push away, and is delay the best they can come up with?
Yeah, you know, I think so. Look, most of these things, you know, the activity that we see, that we're all part of, you know, in terms of getting our agenda items in a budget, let's say, you know, they're part of a much larger political game that goes on in Tallahassee. And so, you know, many, many projects, let's say water projects, those type of things, you know, the priority really is to spend more dollars in these areas to actually, you know, complete certain projects that help either clean water, conserve lands, perhaps restore, you know, ecosystems. And so, you know, this year I think, frankly, thanks to the Indian River area, which is in the backyard of Senator Negron, who happens to be the budget chair for the Senate, I think you saw a lot more attention because of that. I think, you know, his motivation, it goes back to all politics is local. And so, you know, what you saw were people clamoring for a resolution to a problem that isn't getting any better. And I think that combination resulted in better policy and more attention being placed on areas that or in areas that really need attention. You know, Florida is broken in so many ways, not only in terms of the attention we put onto environmental issues, but everything from public education to healthcare, as you know. And again, you know, this last 60 days was, as far as I'm concerned, a lot of theater designed to improve the ability of certain people to get elected.
Well, let me. Interesting you should say that, because, of course,
sure,
the relatively speaking, it's business as usual, and for example, we see this bone being tossed to Thrasher. Does the Republicans
yes.
in our legislature just assume that basically the state education system is just a placeholder for retired politicians?
You know, it's interesting. I think some people look at it as that. You know, it's interesting. And look, there have been Democrats and Republicans that move into these jobs. I don't even know if it's a lateral type of move. It's usually an upgrade, frankly.
I'm sure,
you know,
it's just commitment
I don't
to
know
education.
What the president of FSU gets. Well, yeah, I mean, the president of FSU, I don't know what they get paid. It's certainly more than $29,000, which is basically, you know, what legislators are paid. But, you know, if you look at that type of situation, you know, and I believe Senator Thrasher, you know, is a graduate and is very close to FSU, and certainly that makes sense, but, you know, this is a public institution, and you know, I think you deserve in Florida to have the most elite intellectuals and you know, presidents of universities put into place, and you know, you would expect perhaps a much more vigorous, rigid process, you know, looking at candidates, and something that takes a long time to do. You don't see that necessarily in this situation. And, you know, there's been all kind of speculation surrounding, you know, this latest information about filling the vacancy. But, you know, I think it also, it kind of casts a pretty dark cloud over where we are as a state when we're kind of hand-picking, hand-choosing, cherry-picking, whatever you want to call it, people that are going to run universities.
Maybe we can find a slush fund and build them an airport or a lovely set of buildings.
The slush funds, sadly, for Floridians are generally, you know, trust funds.
Yeah.
Funds that, you know, the legislature sets up to pay for really important things, and then basically, without any trust at all, they use those dollars to fund the general revenue and forget about the programs they were set up to, you know, actually fund. So I guess it's all how you look at, you know, how we handle money in the state as to how you define trust funds versus slush funds.
Yeah, let me go to a more serious topic. You are Democratic policy chair, and
correct.
I've been puzzled from time to time about some of the party's presence or lack of presence on legislative priorities, and you know, it seems to me that the Democratic Party has at least what's visible anyway, it doesn't really seem to have a lot of energy to support our legislative efforts, and
right.
You know, we're in the middle of you know, what is theoretically the preparation for a primary, and the party seems to be sort of absent, at least visibly.
Mm-hmm. Right.
As policy chair, you know, how do you see Democratic policy being shaped as we prepare for a gubernatorial election, another legislative session?
Right.
Give us your positive perspective, sir.
No. I could jump right in there. I mean, I think, you know, when you've gone 16 years, arguably, without a statewide state official, you know, what you find sometimes is a lack of a large following on a lot of different issues. And case in point, you know, the last statewide Democrat state official on the cabinet was Alex Sink. Alex was able to make decisions as the CFO, and her decisions basically weighed very, very heavily on policy and where individual legislators, both in the Senate and the House, would end up on a particular issue. And so what I mean by that is if you're on the floor and a particular bill comes up and, you know, you're wondering about the background, but the CFO's office provides an opinion onto the value or otherwise of a particular bill, you tend to look at that and you look at it seriously and you basically weigh what it's saying and how you're going to vote. And there were plenty of times when Alex Sink was CFO that while you were on the floor, a memo would be issued on that CFO letterhead, and it would give you an indication as to, you know, what the motivation of a particular bill was, whether it be helpful, whether it be something that was harmful. We don't have that in the state of Florida. Basically, you know, we've got we have 45 people in the House from various regions of the state of Florida. You've got 14 from various regions in the Senate, and you have independent minds, and those independent minds come from far different places sometimes on many issues. You know, I think what this tells you, it's not, you know, necessarily the party actually that has an influence on policy. It really, at this point, are the individual members that make up the legislature. If, you know, you look at the Republicans, they've got tremendous leadership. They basically have complete power and say so in the cabinet. You've got a governor. You have one senator, you know, U.S. senator. And you've got 16 years of appointments that have been made by various governors that basically are appointments that mimic ideology. And so it's very, very easy to understand why it looks like, you know, externally that Republicans generally walk in one direction and Democrats generally walk in one direction, but on certain issues there is not a primary voice on those issues. And that's where I think you get a bit of fracturing when it comes to certain things that may look simple, you know, in terms of what your opinion is, whether you support something or not support something in Palm Beach County, let's say, as opposed to a Democrat from another area of the state of Florida that is really, very conservative in its ideology and how the districts are made up. And I think that really is an important component to, you know, understanding the situation we're in now.
Let me ask you this. I remember the lesson of LBJ, where as a legislative leader, he was able to cajole, coerce, or whatever you want to call it, his team into some really aggressive stances and really did some legislation that was remarkable in changing the country. And obviously, as a minority party in the legislature, you don't have neither the resources nor the power, in large part, to do that sort of thing. But I was wondering if you could tell us: do the Democrats in the House and Democrats in the Senate get together for strategy sessions?
Yeah, well, I mean, we do and we don't. You know, there are laws that prohibit us as a group from sitting down quietly behind closed doors and doing things that are public business.
Well,
and
on
so,
camera,
you know,
if need be.
Yeah. Say it again.
I was joking. I said, well, then on camera, if not, doing public business behind the scenes, yeah.
Oh, yeah, well, you know, there are always discussions that occur that are outside of, you know, the site or the pickup of a microphone. But you know, as a caucus, you know, I can speak to, you know, the House side. We always conduct those type of public, you know, business decisions with the caucus, with cameras rolling and, you know, with press there. And you know, we generally do that in most instances. There are very few things that we've done over the years that I can recall where we've not done that way. And so, you know, when you talk about policy development, when we're in session, we meet every day we go onto the floor. We have a pre-caucus meeting where we openly discuss where we are on certain issues. We discuss, you know, some of the strategies involved on those issues. And, you know, we make decisions as a group where we can to be supportive of one another and decisions. And, you know, one of the decisions this year that we made early on as a group was combating and taking a position against the corporate voucher idea, which basically removes public education dollars, tax dollars, from the public education system and moves those towards private, you know, religious schools in many instances. And so we had a session-long position, caucus position, against that idea. So, you know, in those instances, we can do it. And, you know, the dynamics are different on every issue, but we do have those discussions. You know, if, in fact, we had a governor that we could call our own, we'd have tremendous, you know, leverage over what we couldn't do, and we'd be able to involve ourselves in a lot more policy, you know, discussions that currently, because we do not have an edge anywhere in the state government in terms of cabinet members or others, we just don't have that ability to leverage a larger part of the discussion.
Let me ask you a question about a quote I found of yours goes back to March. And the comment was to the effect that democracy in action, the problem is the budget process, not the spending, House Democrat Pafford said. Could you elaborate a little bit? Obviously, there used to be more participation. Now there's not so much. Is that the idea?
Yeah, many, many years ago, there was an ability for, you know, 120 members to have more say in the budget development. Currently, the way the system's set up, you know, let's say you and I are budget chairs for transportation and healthcare, as an example, you know, you're the healthcare guy, and you've got wait lists, you've got all kind of other issues with people, you know, living with disabilities, and I'm the guy out there who's building roads and planting trees along state roads and you know, thinking about maybe putting new sun pass overhangs in, crosswalks, potholes, bridges. Let's just assume that there is a need to wipe out those wait lists for those seniors that you're in charge of, you know, making their lives better. Unless an allocation is made by only the speaker, that's who makes the allocation, to provide those that ability to make those payments for those improvements in those seniors' lives, you are stuck with what you get. So let's say there's $10 that is given to you, and $20 is given to me for DOT projects. Once the allocation from the speaker's office occurs, you are not permitted, as the healthcare chair, to reach into my allocation, which might be healthcare. I'm sorry, which is transportation. I'm getting confused now. And you're not allowed to take a dollar to make somebody's life better. And those are the rules that are set up. Now, to compound that problem, allocations are made behind closed doors. There are very, very few people involved with that decision. There are discussions that go on between both chambers and the governor's office, and there are political motivations for making those allocations. And so those allocations are made usually 20 to 30 days into the 60-day session. So really there is no wiggle room, nor is it really available to the average member to have a discussion about what I just talked about. The allocation at the end of the day is the allocation you are provided. And, you know, where I see this process as being more helpful, potentially, is, you know, we need to open up the process not only to these type of discussions in terms of where the real needs and priorities are way before 20 to 30 days in. You know, we need to be understanding where, in fact, we need to allocate dollars and be part of the speaker's decision. That's currently not the problem, and thus the process, which is what the quote said, is inevitably, at the end of the day, a major problem to developing policy that's good for all Floridians, not just a few.
Okay. Let me ask you this. The ongoing effort by the Republicans to siphon off public funds, whether it be to privatize prison guards or to take what seems to be not enough money for education and somehow squeeze off profit as well. How does that battle stand this year in this past session? Were they able to get their hands on more public funds, or was that effort held at bay for a while?
Yeah, you know, I mean, look, from year to year, it's going to be about the same. I think any time you have members of the legislature who sign the loyalty oath supporting the Grover Norquist, you know, anti-tax type of language, then you're going to be continually from year to year constrained in terms of being able to raise more dollars for any particular need. You either get a larger allocation, which I discussed a few minutes ago, or you don't. And generally, you know, I would argue that as much as the state of Florida population has blossomed to upwards of 20 million, the size of the budget pie has remained relatively the same size. And so you're going to continue seeing smaller slices of pie to feed more people. When you have that type of situation in place, you have a very, very difficult time, you know, paying for prisons, paying for education, paying for health care, paying for environmental needs. And you're basically forcing yourself to find cheaper ways to perform the same duties and government services, which are basically services by the people, for the people, and you begin looking outside to find it on the cheap. And so, you know, what you described in terms of prisons or corrections or you know, those types of issues, that's not going to change. This year there was no major expansion, but because the basic rules remain the same, you can expect, you know, it to come back in future years, unless we get, you know, a new governor.
I know that to primary or not to primary is a difficult question for many Democrats. But if we were to imagine a hypothetical, do you think that public participation in the selection of candidates is in general a good thing, or so complicated and so demanding of resources that it should be avoided at all costs? Can I frame it?
Repeat the question one more time. I want to make sure I understood it.
Okay. I'm trying to do this delicately. And what I was basically getting at...
You can rip the Band-Aid off. It's fine.
Okay. Then let me put it this way. There are Democrats who argue that a primary divides resources, spends resources unnecessary, and gives the opposition, I could say loyal opposition, but I don't think so in the case of Republicans, gives the opposition too many potential grab points. And there, the other alternative point is that when you have a primary process, it gives the public the opportunity to participate more in candidate selection. So do you put yourself more on the public participation side or more on the let's limit the damage and let's limit the expenditure of resources side of things?
Well, you know, to understand politics, one of the basic ideas is this, and especially, you know, when you're running against a Republican Party. Generally speaking, if you've got an opponent, they're going to come up with stuff one way or another, or they're going to make up stuff one way or another, and they're going to have tons of cash to basically get that message out there. You know, if you're a Democrat in the state of Florida, generally speaking, you're always behind in terms of fundraising, and you're always at a disadvantage. So it really, you know, doesn't matter in my mind one way. Well, it does matter one way or another. You know, they're going to come up with stuff anyway. That's just the name of the game. And, you know, if you're a Republican, you're going to generally have the resources to do that. And again, you know, this is 16 years of complete control and power. That's where dollars go. People don't want to invest in candidates that can't be part of a plurality to pass certain bills. And that's why that explains some of the problems we have. You know, in terms of, you know, primaries and debates and participation, I think it does help the process to get candidates in front of people talking about issues and, you know, having those debates. I don't see why you wouldn't do that. If anything, you're putting your name out there and you're demonstrating publicly that you're very credible and a viable candidate to be, you know, part of the office that you're seeking. So, you know, to me, it doesn't make sense.
Okay, that's a good answer, and I think very thoughtful. Let me ask you this. The three committees you're serving on, the Agricultural and Natural Resources Appropriations Subcommittee, Appropriations Committee, and the Joint Legislative Budget Committee, seems to me that, you know, you had as close a view to the Republican appropriations process as one can get, unless you're...
As they permit.
Yeah, unless you're actually dealing the cards.
Right.
Could you just give kind of a glimpse of some of that from what you can see? Yeah.
You know, every committee that I sit on has an appropriations, a budget function. You know, we'll start with the Agriculture and Natural Resource Appropriations Subcommittee. That committee meets and talks about water projects, Everglades restoration. It basically funds everything from protecting the Florida panther to cleaning up water. The budget process is something that limits the policy discussions in that particular committee. Generally, we're concerned with the dollar amounts that go to certain places within the budget, specifically the ag and natural resource, environmental type of things. We have a very good chair who is a Republican. His name is Ben Albritton. And, I have a very good relationship with him. I believe, his hands are tied most of the time in terms of dealing with the single allocation that's provided by the Speaker. And, right from the get-go, this committee is kind of strapped. We can't provide the dollars that are necessary to fund an overwhelming number of projects that are worthy of funding. The full appropriations committee is the House Appropriations Committee. It's considered to be pretty powerful. But again, the underlying appropriations committees, like I just explained, for ag and natural resource appropriations, they are given an allocation. The chair provides a proposed budget, which is bumped up to this full appropriations committee. We have about 7 hours, sometimes longer, sometimes shorter, to debate and ask questions, and then take a vote in that committee, and then it goes to the full floor. There isn't a whole lot of time in any of those committees to really make much change. The way the process, going back to your process question and my quote, the way the process is set out and the rules that are in place, it forces people to go have private meetings with budget chairs behind closed doors, and that's never good for the public. But that's the reality. In terms of the Joint Legislative Budget Commission, that is a commission that meets generally every quarter, and it's made up of representatives and senators, and we basically take up issues that require changes, usually, in how dollars are spent or requests are made from agency heads to adjust things throughout the year, so they can either spend more money, ask for more money, reallocate funds. And that's, in my view, a very dangerous commission because so much of their activity is not part of the normal budget process, which I just got done complaining about. It helps fund things, but I don't believe that it's necessarily done in an open way. And I'm pretty confident that suggestion I just made in terms of feeling about that process is shared not only by Democrats but also Republicans.
Let me ask you one last question, if I may. I really appreciate your time. You've been very generous. The Corps of Engineers basically put a roadblock in front of this process about cleaning up the Everglades and rerouting it. There's 1,000 reasons why things can't be done. And it strikes me and many other people that it's kind of odd, since everyone's aware that this is the process we're trying to reroute some of that polluted water and get some of it flowing south. I'm wondering, I've asked several people what they think the real underlying reason why they've decided to roadblock this cleanup, and since there's been so much activity to try to get the damage that's being done to St. Lucie and to the Withlacoochee, to get that mitigated in some way, what do you think the underlying cause is for this roadblock? They're going to study it for a while, God knows how long.
Yeah, so, obviously the Corps said they needed more time, but, I think the underlying problem is this. When Rick Scott was elected, one of the first things he did was hack major portions of the South Florida Water Management District's budget. Employees were basically shown the door. The governor then went to South Florida Water Management, did a press conference and availability on the fact that he, made South Florida Water Management a smaller agency. Basically what he did was, he neutered the agency and brought it to its knees. And so an agency responsible for cleanup and restoration and then preservation of the most unique water systems in the entire world was basically dismantled. And taking with that expertise that, had been assembled over decades. to perform a very important function, which is water availability and clean water, not only for 7 million people, but, you know, the Everglades. You fast forward 3.5 years, you've got projects that have not been completed, you've got projects that don't have budgets to be completed, and you've got a South Florida Water Management District that, you know, I have heard internally is a bit disorganized. And it's not saying anything about the people that are currently there, but, you know, when you're under-budgeted, when you don't have the resources you need to make big decisions and thoroughly vet projects and ideas, and in this circumstance, you know, restoring the Everglades, you're not able to function as you would, and you are not able to provide detail to an agency like the Army Corps. I think it's disappointing because, you know, obviously I'm very much in support of getting that water moving south. And frankly, I think, you know, Senator Negron would share that concern that this problem that's been created over 100 years, now all of a sudden it's getting a lot of heat because of the you know, putrid discharges into the Indian River and out to the Caloosahatchee. This is not going to be a quick fix because we've wasted, in my opinion, 3.5 years. We could have had an opportunity to talk about, you know, swapping land and creating ways to move the water south, but we've not done that. And so, very long answer. You know, I think the true root and cause of this mess goes back 3.5 years when the governor interrupted what was working pretty well.
I see. If there's one comment you'd like to make to speak to Democrats, progressive Democrats across the state as they prepare for what may be a primary season, what may be otherwise the election coming up in the fall, what advice would you give or what insight could you offer as these people prepare for this primary that will hopefully take place at the end of the summertime?
Sure. Well, you know, in terms of the primary, hopefully, you know, less damage is good. Certainly, I believe there will be a primary. Once we get past the primary, I would say never forget. You know, we've had 3.5 years of what I would consider probably the most harmful governor we've had since, you know, prior to Reconstruction. The governor has turned his back on Floridians that are taxpaying Floridians. He's turned his back on, you know, everything that provides quality of life for people. And he's satisfied with that type of system that gives these largest corporations and the wealthiest Floridians far more than what we expect. When you're denying health care to 6 people a day who end up dying at the end of that day, when you're tearing apart water management districts, you know, these are prime examples of things that have occurred, including, you know, hacking away $1.3 billion of public education dollars and then trying to come back this year and saying it's historic funding when actually the truth is, you know, the per pupil spending levels are not historic at all. And so, you know, that's what we need to keep our eye on. You know, this is a critically important election. And going back to the beginning of our conversation where we talked about, you know, state leadership, we are desperate for a governor that will represent Floridians and taxpaying Floridians, us folk who are out there working every day who may not have the time to, you know, read the local newspaper or, you know, really engage. But we need to remind them, too, that, you know, the reason they're lives have not improved is because what we've had has been taken away. We've been devalued as a middle class, and we need to grab hold of that and take it back. And that's going to be critical in November.
Mark, can I ask you one more difficult question, sir, before you leave?
Sure.
Who's the Democratic Party of Florida going to run against our Republican senator?
Marco?
Oh, yeah.
God, who knows? I have no idea. You know,
may I suggest you, sir?
Continues to be me? No. There's no place for me to go. And you know, as a lowly House member with a pretty big responsibility of, you know, guiding a 40-plus member caucus. I've got my hands full. I'm enjoying this role, and I've got blinders on to make sure that I can do that as well as I can do it. You know, in terms of political future, you never say never, but, you know, I've got two good senators, three actually from Palm Beach County that are young and lively, and they're not going anywhere. So I may be back in the ranks of unelected activist, and, you know, that satisfies me just as well, and I'll be happy to do that, and maybe you'll create another seat in the studio for me, and I can start asking questions of people.
Oh, absolutely.
At some point.
Anytime, Mike.
Yeah,
anytime.
There you go.
Hey, thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, good.
And we really appreciate
you
giving us
a
sample of your wisdom. Thanks again, Mark.
Oh, my pleasure. Take care.
Okay, bye-bye.
So that was Mark Pafford, and now I've got my next guest ready to go. Good evening. Welcome. Hi there, 651-587.
Yep, this is Alan Mackey.
Hi, Alan. How you doing, guy?
Good. How about you?
Good, good. So, sir, tell us, what's going on up there in the Midwest? I understand that Michigan raised their minimum wage. How's things going in Minnesota?
Yeah, well, both Minnesota and Michigan had a minimum wage increase. What's interesting is that the Democrats, with their supermajority here in Minnesota, increased the minimum wage in installments to $9.50 an hour. It'll take 3 years to get there. In Michigan, the Republicans with the supermajority raised the minimum wage to $9.25 an hour with a four-year installment plan. So, you know, the Democrats came to office talking about they were going to be for making the minimum wage a real living wage. Well, obviously, $9.50 an hour is not a living wage. $9.25 is not a real living wage. Obama's $10.10. Proposal is not a real living wage. You know, we need to start talking about tying the minimum wage to actual cost of living factors, realizing that working people all across this country, every working class family is experiencing a cost of living crisis. And if anybody doesn't believe this, you can just go to buy gas, pay a heating or electric bill, or pay for college tuition. There is a cost of living crisis for working class families in this country, and neither of the two major political parties are discussing this or responding to this crisis that's facing every single working class family in this country at this time. You know, we hear a lot of excuses from Democrats in Michigan or whether it's in Florida saying, well, if we had a supermajority of Democrats, things would be different. Well, here in Minnesota, we have a supermajority of Democrats who haven't done any better than the Republicans in Michigan. And, you know, Rick Snyder is not a moderate Republican. He's a very reactionary Republican. And we have to ask why Democrats with supermajorities can't do any better than a guy like Rick Snyder has done in Michigan. So, you know, these are some of the problems. Here in Minnesota, working people, even the union people, the members of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, who are state employees, all across Minnesota are under tremendous pressure, and they're being forced to relinquish their rights, and they're being subjected to all kinds of attacks by this Democratic government here in Minnesota, all kinds of ridiculous attacks when it comes to things like just their rights on the job, their pay increases. Supposedly, the Democrats voted for this 2% pay increases for state employees, and the way they're getting out from under this is they're initiating disciplinary charges against state employees and then saying that because they haven't performed according to, they're not entitled to the 2% increase and that the state legislature and the governor have approved. Very, very dirty. And that the working people in this country, all across this country, are under perpetual and never-ending attack right now, whether it's from Democrats or Republicans. And that's the state of affairs right now here in Minnesota and across the Midwest.
You know, let me ask you this. A lot of us have taken heart about this, I mean, nationwide, actually even international recognition of the terrible state of wages and the terrible state, the lack of wage increases, and not even to mention the wage disparity between upper management and the workers. Do you take any heart from that, or what's it going to take to put some steel in the spine of these Democrats?
Well, I don't think we'll ever get any steel in the spine of the Democrats. The only way that the Democrats might possibly move is if millions upon millions of working people take to the streets in this country like they have been doing in other countries, Greece and Portugal and Spain and many other countries where workers are taking to the streets demanding their rights and that their livelihoods be respected. The Democrats haven't come forward with anything as far as a living minimum wage, and this is what we have to begin to talk about. And I think the only way it's going to be discussed is if we come together and say we need a new political party to challenge the stranglehold that the Democrats and the Republicans together have over us. And both the Democrats and Republicans, irrespective of what the Democrats say, the Democrats and Republicans both work for Wall Street's interests. And the minimum wage and this whole struggle for a real living wage proves that, in my opinion. And, you know, to have Democrats proposing these horrible, you know, poverty minimum wages and calling them wage increases, it's just despicable. These miserly wages will not bring anybody out of poverty. You know, we have Democrats saying, well, it's a beginning. No, it is not a beginning. A beginning would be tie the minimum wage to actual cost of living figures. The figures used by the United States Department of Labor's own Bureau of Labor Statistics, their figures are the most accurate figures in the world when it comes to explaining the standard of living of working people. So there's no reason why we're paying these people a lot of money to compile these figures on cost of living, why those figures shouldn't be the figures used to establish what a minimum wage should be in this country, a real living wage. For instance, we had a Democratic governor here in Minnesota. Before he was elected, he went all over the state talking about if he was elected, working people would be receiving real living wages and not poverty wages. This is what he said. And he said that working people, because they work hard for a living, they're entitled to real living wages. Well, once he got elected, we saw that how two-faced Mark Dayton was. Mark Dayton is a billionaire. His wealth comes from the Target Corporation. His inherited wealth comes from the Target Corporation. And, you know, we all know what kind of wages the Target Corporation pays to people, these terrible poverty wages. And this is what he wanted to do. He wanted to make sure that he gave the employers a good deal rather than the working people whose votes that he took to get elected. And this is the real problem. We've got to break free from this two-party crap, this stranglehold that the Democrats and Republicans have over the political process. We've got to break free from Wall Street. We've got to struggle for power against Wall Street, for political and economic power. This is what it's all about. Putting our faith in the Democrats just isn't going to cut it. No matter how many votes we deliver for these Democrats, they're never happy, and they never respond to the needs of working people, and this whole minimum wage issue proves that.
Alan, let me ask you a question. Have you heard about the pressure being put on the Democratic Party in New York, where the working party has insisted that if Cuomo wants their support, he better do something about real Democratic issues. And supposedly he's made a pact that he's going to do that. Have you followed that part of the discussion?
Yes, I followed that for quite a while now. And, you know, this Working Families Party, they're not what they're cut out to be either. They really stabbed some people in the Green Party in the back and during the last elections. And they keep talking about how they want the Democrats to do this and the Democrats to do that. But even when the Democrats don't do what they say needs to be done, and I agree with them often that what needs to be done, but when the Democrats don't do what they say needs to be done, they still turn around and give their support to the Democrats, claiming that the Democrats are somehow better than the Republicans. But, you know, we can see in real life, that when it comes to things like the minimum wage, the Democrats are no better than the Republicans. The majority of the states with supermajority Democrats didn't even raise their minimum wage as much as Rick Snyder did, this reactionary Republican governor in Michigan. They didn't even raise their minimum wage above what he did. You know, Minnesota now has one of the highest minimum wages, which in my opinion is nothing to brag about. Everybody knows you can't live on $9.50 an hour and feed your family. I mean, that's just common sense. It's a truth. And for these people to come along and say, oh, vote for us because we raised the minimum wage. Well, raising the minimum wage from one miserly poverty wage to another miserly poverty wage, in my opinion, does not qualify for getting the votes of working people. And the Working Family Party in New York is going to have to respond to this. Working people in New York, New York has one of the atrocious cost of living that you can imagine, the rents, the food. If you've ever visited New York, you know about the rents, you know about the food, you know about the price of gasoline and everything else in New York. Nobody in New York can live on even $10 an hour. It's impossible. Not even a single person can live under a bridge at $10 an hour. Just impossible. You know, what are these Democrats thinking of? They're thinking that they can say that they've raised the minimum wage, and just because they've raised it, that we're supposed to turn around and vote for them. And in New York, it's the exact same thing. I would encourage people to look at the alternative parties, whether it's the Green Party or some other party. We should start to hold conferences across this country on how we're going to establish a new political movement, a new progressive political party in this country that is working class based and is for peace and social and economic justice. That's the solution.
Absolutely agree, sir.
Not to continue voting for Democrats.
Absolutely, I agree. You know, I grew up in a working family. I grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, Uniontown. I support unions, and every year of my life when I voted Democrat, except last year. I just couldn't do it anymore. I've been holding my nose and voting Democrat. I just couldn't do it anymore. So I voted Green this last time, and I absolutely agree with 100% with what you're going to say. Hey, let me ask you one more question, sir. I know you're very involved in union activity. You know, has the national unions given up? Is there you know, are they not going to try to provide whatever pressure they've got left to do something? I mean, my God, the Democratic Party's been living off the unions for the longest time. Can't they demand a change?
Well, in the way I view the situation right now, things are not going to change in the unions until we have rank-and-file movements, actual rank-and-file organizations, where working people are going to be taking control of their own unions. Right now, we've got millionaire labor leaders in this country that don't understand what life is like for working people. If you look at the executive council of the AFL-CIO and Richard Trumka, the president of the AFL-CIO, all of these people are multimillionaires. How can a multimillionaire possibly understand the plight of a working person that goes to the store and has to make a decision of whether to buy bread or milk? You know, these millionaire labor leaders, they can go into any store and buy anything they want. They have no problem with this. So, you know, but for working people are having a real struggle. When I say that we have a cost of living crisis in this country, that's exactly what I mean. I'm not exaggerating that point. I think every working class family, every working person in this country understands that we have this cost of living crisis in this country, but none of these millionaire labor leaders understand this. They just don't understand because they're multimillionaires. Richard Trumka is a multimillionaire along with his buddies, at least probably 54 of the 56 or so members of the AFL-CIO Executive Council are all multimillionaires, and this is something that has to change. We need real working people in leadership positions in organized labor. And until that happens, we're not going to see much change in the country. That's what it took back in the 1930s. The people that organized these mass industrial unions, whether it's the UAW or the United Steelworkers, these were rank-and-file workers right off the lines. They led the union while they worked on the lines and in the mines and the mills. You know, they were not millionaire labor leaders. They understood the day-to-day struggles of the working people because they were of and from the working class, and this is what it's going to take. These millionaire labor leaders, they simply do not understand or care whether or not the Democrats come up with a real living wage, and this is a big problem. And, you know, working people, the unorganized workers in this country who are the majority of the working class, like 90% of the workers in this country, we never asked Richard Trumka to negotiate a minimum wage for us. He can't even negotiate a wage increase for his own members. All that he can negotiate is concession contract after concession contract. That is not a labor leader. Profits are soaring to all-time highs in this country, and we have labor leaders that cannot negotiate anything other than a concession contract out of these corporations that are making billions upon billions of dollars in profits, record profits. How do these labor leaders explain concession contract after concession contract in a political and economic environment like we're in right now, where Wall Street is in control, and they're in control because of the enormous profits that they're making? You know, this makes no sense at all. Richard Trumka can't represent the workers that he's supposed to represent who are paying the dues, and yet he's trying to talk for unorganized workers who are making these poverty minimum wages. This is ridiculous. We need people to rise from the rank and file to lead these movements.
You're absolutely right, sir. You know, I have to honestly admit, I'm puzzled. How do you, working for working people, get to be a millionaire, huh? That's amazing.
Well, you're rewarded very well when you work for the corporations. Corporations, they're very happy with these concessionary contracts that have been coming down the pike for the last 30 years or so in this country. So, these people like Richard Trumka are rewarded very well. They get paid, huge salaries. They get paid for sitting on all these boards of these health and welfare and pension boards. We've seen how lousy the union's pensions have lost literally hundreds of billions of dollars in the stock markets and everything over the last 8 to 10 years. And yet these people get these people from all these different unions who sit on these pension boards, their salaries are enormous. They get paid hundreds of thousands of dollars. Some of them, like in the Teamsters, millions of dollars for sitting on these pension boards that are losing money left and right. Workers may not have any of those pensions from the union pension funds in another 10 or 12 years because of the loss that they're suffering in the stock market. So there's not even any accounting. We haven't had any accounting of how much loss there's been to union pension funds over the last 8 to 10 years. No accounting whatsoever. And this is criminal activity because, there's a certain duty. They call it the United States Department of Labor calls it a duty to represent the workers who are paying the dues. And these union officials, these union labor leaders, have completely and totally ignored their duty to represent the working people whose dues are paying their salaries. This is a crime, and it's really a crime. I don't exaggerate either. It's criminal activity when they do not work to represent the workers. When they are working hand-in-hand with the bosses instead of working for the benefit and the well-being of the workers, this is a crime. They're not being paid through union dues to work for the employers. They're being paid by the union members. They're being paid through the union dues to work for those members, and they're not doing that. I can cite case after case of people being fired here in Minnesota in this AFSCME union. It's a paper union right now. AFSCME used to be a militant, rank-and-file type union in this country. Today it's become nothing but a paper union collecting union dues. Workers are being fired left and right for the most petty disciplinary actions. And this union, this AFSCME union, there's a millionaire, Elliot Seed, who is the head of District 5 for AFSCME here in Minnesota. He will not lift a finger to represent these workers who have been unjustly fired from their jobs, some of them working 8, 10, 12, even 15 and 16 years jobs who have been terminated from those jobs for the most petty disciplinary actions, including, I might add, people are being fired from the state of Minnesota for exercising their rights under the Family and Medical Leave Act. This is a real disgrace. This is a crime. And I can show you documents where the United States Department of Labor has said to workers, you are right, you are justified in taking the leave, but our department doesn't have the resources to provide you with an attorney. So these workers have to go out and find their own attorneys because the union won't even represent them properly. This is a failure of the duty to represent. Every worker in this country that's a member of the union and paying union dues should understand those words, duty to represent. This is what every elected union official has a responsibility to do, to represent the workers, from the union steward to the local president, and the members of the local board of the unions to the state and federal officials of these unions. They have a duty, a legal duty to represent the workers, and they're not undertaking those duties, and they should be held accountable for that. Workers should. I would encourage workers to file complaints with the National Labor Relations Board when these union officials do not come up to the bat and for their duty to represent workers. And this is a terrible situation. You know, we have unions that will spend millions of dollars, literally hundreds of millions of dollars, to go out and elect Democrats to public office, like we have here in Minnesota, Democrats that are firing union members left and right, Democrats that will not initiate a real living wage. You know, this is a terrible situation. We got to say we don't want any more this buddy-buddy crap with the Democrats. We need a working-class political party in this country, and it's got to start someplace. Like a rank-and-file movement, rank-and-file workers are going to have to take the initiative. We can't wait for people like Richard Trumka to start a new political party. He's just not going to do it. The members of the AFL-CIO Executive Board, they are not going to do it. It's going to take actual rank-and-file workers to get this job done, just like they organized the unions to begin with.
Let me ask you this. You know, across the country, regulations on environmental pollution are loosened and loosened, and what they can't loosen, they fix by cutting back on staff for environmental controls, environmental oversight. Are you seeing the same thing up in Minnesota?
Oh, definitely. There's a big struggle, a huge struggle going on here in Minnesota right now over sulfide mining. These copper nickel mining companies want to come into northern Minnesota. Up to now, there's been iron ore mining. Now they want to come in with this dangerous sulfide mining, which is required to mine nickel and copper and more precious metals. And the Democrats have already lifted the limits upon which these mining companies can pollute the waters and the air and the land here in Minnesota. And there's a big fight going on because the wild rice, which is a major crop that Native Americans survive on, and they use this as a means for their livelihood, to part of their subsistence livelihood, along with fishing and some timber. Well, the wild rice is dying off because the mining companies are polluting the water where the wild rice grows. And now they've raised the limit, so it's going to make the situation even worse. Many scientists are saying there will no longer be wild rice in Minnesota, and Minnesota is one of the major producers of wild rice in this country and in North America. And it's an important cash crop for Native Americans. It sells for around $8 a pound. So, you know, you take away that subsistence livelihood from people, and they're going to become even poorer. You have, you know, a poor population on these Indian reservations to begin with, and they get a little income from harvesting wild rice, and now they won't even be able to get that. Nobody will want to buy the wild rice because it's contaminated. You know, who wants to eat poison? You know, and the Democrats don't even care about that. They've turned right around and they've raised, instead of lowering the limits to which a mining company can pollute the air and the water, they've raised the limits to allow them to pollute even more. And this is happening all over across the country. We see it happening in Alaska. We see it happening down in New Mexico. We see it happening in Colorado and Montana. The exact same pattern, you know, and this is part of the greed. The Wall Street greed, the drive for maximum profit. The only thing that matters is profits, profits, profits in this country anymore. People don't matter. The environment doesn't matter. You know, whether it's working people's right to a real decent standard of living and decent jobs, or whether it's the environment, it doesn't matter to these Wall Street people. They will ruin people's lives in order to extract their profit. That's the bottom line.
Incredible. Now, I know you work with a lot of Native Americans in the casino arena. How are things going there?
Well, we've won quite a victory, actually, in Leech Lake, on the Leech Lake Reservation. We've been pushing for years now for real living wages. And people, we've talked about how wages should relate to cost of living. Now, the Leech Lake Tribal Council passed the highest minimum wage in the United States, $10.25 an hour. You know, that's nothing to write home about or be overjoyed about. But when the Leech Lake Reservation, a reservation of 10,000 people living in abject poverty, 85% poverty on that reservation, when the tribal council can be forced to raise the minimum wage to $10.25 an hour, that should cause everybody to take a look at that situation and say, hey, the people there, the casino workers there, went out and they struggled for a better wage, and they won it, the best wage, the best minimum wage in this country. And why can't the governments, state governments and the federal government, come up with a minimum wage, at least the equivalent of the Leech Lake Indian Reservation of $10.25 an hour?
Very good. That's great. That's great. It's good to hear a little bit of good news. I was interviewing some people from the West Virginia area who were suffering from that those spills, you know. And
right.
They said, we're feeling pretty good because our legislature is about to meet, and they've been promising us tighter regulations on water pollution. Well, Alan, you probably won't be surprised to hear that while they did tighten the rules on water pollution, guess what industry they gave a pass to? The coal.
Probably the coal industry. Yeah, I mean, this is the so-called logic of their thinking. And, you know, these people should be ashamed to even confront the public and tell the public that they did something like this. You know, I've been to West Virginia. I purposely made a trip to West Virginia, I think it was in 2003, because I wanted to sort of compare, you know, the Rockefellers control the coal mines and the Rockefellers control the iron ore mines. And I wanted to see how the living of the people, you know, compared in West Virginia and Minnesota. And I'll tell you, the Iron Range in Minnesota is being called the Appalachia of the North, because if you come to visit the Iron Range in Minnesota, the poverty and despair is just like you find in the coal fields of West Virginia. And it's not coincidental that the Rockefellers control things down there in West Virginia and the Rockefellers control things on the Iron Range here in Minnesota. Ironically, the Rockefellers even have a major controlling interest along with the mobsters in the Indian gaming industry. So it's not surprising that, you know, we have the problems that we have in the Indian gaming industry, where you got all across this country close to 2 million workers employed in this Indian gaming industry working in these smoke-filled casinos. They're loud, noisy smoke-filled casinos. The people have no rights under state or federal labor laws. This is what the employers want for all workers in this country, and people should take a look at the way these people are being forced to work in the Indian gaming industry, because that's what's coming to all workers, again, in the United States. This is what existed at one time when my grandfather had to work in the underground mines on the Iron Range. He had no rights, none at all. If he circulated union cards, he was considered a criminal. You know, the police would arrest him on behalf of the mining companies. He'd be tossed out of his job. He was blacklisted. And, you know, we have the same thing going on in the Indian gaming industry right now. And it's not coincidental that the Rockefellers have controlled the iron ore industry and the coal mining industry, and now they have major influence in the Indian gaming industry, and workers are treated the exact same way, like crap. You know, I'd use another word, but I think that you probably have a family program here. But workers are just being treated, the way workers in this country are being treated today is just despicable. And I don't care what industry it's in. It's really bad in this Indian gaming industry for casino workers, but it's not much better if you work at a Walmart or Target store. You know, we have a governor who calls himself a progressive. His inherited wealth, his billions of dollars, have come through the exploitation of poverty-wage workers, first in the Dayton Hudson Company, which developed into the Target stores. And this guy, you know, boasts that he passed a minimum wage of $9.50 an hour that will come into effect in 3 years. This is the epitome of the kind of crap we're getting from these Democrats. And, you know, really, the Democrats are no better than Republicans. I don't care how bad Rick Snyder is in Michigan. The Democrats in Minnesota are no better than Rick Snyder. Not when they can only raise the minimum wage a quarter better than Rick Snyder did.
You know, you're telling some tough truths, buddy. Hey, let me ask you a question. I'm going to ask you to speculate, break out your crystal ball on this one, especially in the context of what you've been telling me. Do you think there's a Democrat out there who's got what it takes to challenge Hillary Clinton? or is she just going to walk away without any kind of primary at all?
I don't think that there's a single Democrat left in this country that has the courage to stand up to Hillary Clinton to start with, and I don't think any of them want to. I think that we've heard a lot about Elizabeth Warren, and we've heard a lot about Bernie Sanders, and I have a lot of respect for Bernie Sanders, the way he struggled over the years. But right now I think that he and Elizabeth Warren are nothing but stalking horses for Hillary Clinton, and this is a dirty shame. I don't think it's going to matter who steps into the Democratic primary as far as members of Congress or the United States Senate. If anybody at all is going to challenge Hillary Clinton, I think chances are nobody will challenge Hillary Clinton in the Democratic primary. But, you know, I think that we got to look to expand beyond the Democratic Party into a real working-class-based progressive people's party in this country. And I don't think we have to look too far to see what kind of party we actually need. I lived in Canada, in Manitoba, Canada, where the New Democratic Party, the socialists of the New Democratic Party, have been in control for most of the last 50 years. And I can tell you from my experience living there that working people have their lives are a heck of a lot better as a result. And I think we need to look at forming a political party that's pretty similar to the New Democratic Party in Canada if we want to get any kind of real traction to you know, have real social and economic justice and a policy of peace in this country. And, you know, most of these, we're hearing a lot of this talk about economic populism from Robert Reich and Bernie Sanders and even Hillary Clinton and Elizabeth Warren. But if you notice, they never talk about peace and war as part of their economic agenda. These wars are just terrible, not only in the cost of lives, but in the financial cost. There's nobody with any common sense would even think that we could fill the potholes in this country as long as we're bombing big holes in other countries and murdering people in these drone strikes and everything else, which are costing us trillions of dollars. You know, we have 800 military bases, maybe a few more scattered all over the world. We should have 800 healthcare centers all across our own country instead. You know, as long as we're spending this huge amount on wars, we're never going to have a decent country to live in here in this country anymore. And that imperialism has to be challenged by the people of this country in the first place, by the working people. They're going to have to understand that imperialism is robbing them of decent lives and livelihoods. And we will not make any progress as long as we're spending so much money on wars and militarism. That's just a common basic fact of life, and we're going to have to own up to that. And none of these Democrats are willing to confront that issue.
Well, I'll tell you, it's a pretty serious sight we've got here in Florida. We've got a situation where we have one more Republican who pulled a mask on and calls himself a Democrat now, who is running without any debate, without any discussion. He's got money, so by God, he's a Democrat. They can tell because he's got money. And yet there's a woman running who is a former state senator who's a real honest progressive, and the party is not giving her the time of day. Even the women's groups in this state are not giving her the time of day. It's an embarrassment. I asked one of our representatives of the organization, I shall not name it, that claims to want to fund women running for office, especially progressive women. And I said, why are you not funding her? She said, well, you see, we have limited resources. Okay, there's only one woman running for governor, for God's sakes. Why don't you support her? They said, well, you see, we're saving our funds for the legislature. You know what? I think that's grand. But here you've got a real progressive fire-breathing woman running, and you don't have the time or the resources to give her money? Are you kidding me? It's absolutely appalling.
We have the same thing here in Minnesota. The Democrats will actually go out and recruit Republicans to run the Democratic ticket because they can supposedly win. And we've seen this time and time again. We got a fellow here in Minnesota. He's a congressman. Maybe you've heard of him, Colin Peterson.
Yeah.
This guy, he actually is my congressman from the area where I live, is Colin Peterson. And we tried to run a progressive peace candidate against him. And even the unions joined up and attack the progressive that we wanted to run against them in the primary. So, you know, Colin Peterson, his big boast, and this has been reported in the Grand Forks Herald and in many other newspapers around Minnesota, when they interviewed Colin Peterson, they asked him about his politics, and he boasted that he's more conservative than any Republican. And, in fact, he was dating a Republican woman down there in Florida. So, you know,
yeah. It's funny.
He's been
there
for every single war.
There's a gentleman who is running. He ran here as, quote, a progressive Democrat. And when once he got elected, he's calling himself completely bipartisan. He's bipartisan, by God. He's bipartisan. Well, there's a point to partisanship. If there's an agenda, it should be a partisan agenda. You should be supporting the people. You should be supporting working people. To say that you're bipartisan sounds good to the uneducated, but it's not what works.
Exactly. And too much of this, you know, Obama was big on being nonpartisan. He appointed Alan Simpson to head up the Cat Food Commission in the name of bipartisanship. You know, and this is really, in my opinion, where everything started with Barack Obama going off in the wrong direction. I don't think he ever really sincerely intended to go in a progressive direction. And I think that, you know, he lined everything up and he had his ducks in a row, and the people were just there for the picking. There was this, you know, you have all these phony preachers going around the country taking money from people under false pretenses and everything. Well, Obama has done essentially the same thing. I don't know if you've ever seen the movie Elmer Gantry, the
corrupt
preacher. Well, you know, that's what Obama and the Democrats remind me of. They're a bunch of Elmer Gantries. I call them dumb donkeys, and a lot of people don't like that. They say you're calling people names. But, you know, we're being misled by a whole bunch of these Democrats, and they're doing it very intentionally, and they're using us, and they're literally making fools out of us. And they're doing it. They say one thing to get elected, and then they pull this bait and switch. They play this bait and switch game once elected. You know, if a retailer were to pull the same bait and switch tactics, they'd be prosecuted and probably put in jail or fined very heavily. But the Democratic politicians, they can come out for election day and say they're for this and say they're for that, and they turn right around once elected and do just the opposite thing. They pull a bait and a switch, and they're playing us for fools. And we're going to, as working people, we're going to have to see this and confront this. And the only way to deal with it is starting a new progressive political party. That's what we got to do. It's not hard. It's just going to take some time and some effort. And instead of going out and campaigning and wasting our time and our resources on these Democrats, we're going to have to put our time into creating a new political party in this country. You know, we are the majority. We working people are the majority. And there's no reason why we have to take this crap from the few who profit and exploit. And they use racism and the most despicable kinds of divisions to keep people divided, you know, and keep people fighting each other instead of uniting people to create the kind of society that we really need. And that's what we should be thinking of when we think about our new political party, the kind of country we really want to live in, a country that treats people across the world decently and as neighbors and sees people as people that we work in mutual consultation and friendship with and not eager to go to war with them. You know, this is what it's going to take. It's going to take an understanding that working people are the producers of all the wealth in this country, and working people are entitled to the benefits of that wealth, whether it be through universal social systems or, you know, better wages, whatever it takes to provide people with a better standard of living. This is the kind of program we're going to have to stimulate in this country and create a discussion around and go after and fight for. People ask me, what do you want? I say, take a look at the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights. This is what we want. This is the kind of country we want to live in, and we need the universal social programs to create that environment so we all have decent lives. You know, a lot of these politicians will talk about jobs, 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 and then they'll start talking about, oh, we don't want these poverty jobs at Walmart or McDonald's. We want decent jobs. But the thing is, every job should be a decent job. All it takes is decent wages, you know, real living wages, and decent benefits, you know, so some good vacation time for people. You know, in most of Europe, people get 4 weeks vacation. We got people in this country that have never had a vacation in their lives, even though they've worked for 20, 25, and 30 years. This is terrible. People are being denied their Social Security because they don't accumulate enough dollars every quarter to qualify for Social Security. This is something that isn't even being talked about in this country right now. We have people that work for, you know, you have to have so many quarters and to qualify for Social Security. If you haven't made so much money during those quarters, that quarter does not count towards your Social Security, and you will not receive Social Security benefits. We now have hundreds of thousands of people in this country in that situation of people reaching Social Security age but not having the required dollar amount per quarter for their to receive their Social Security benefits. This is a disgrace. No politician is talking about that. We have workers on the iron range here in Minnesota, who, tens of thousands of workers over the last 30 years who these corporations have swindled out of their pensions through these bankruptcy schemes. They put in tens of thousands of dollars thinking they were going to have decent pensions at the end of their working cycle in their lives, and now they have nothing. And these Democrats will not lift a finger to help them. That's terrible.
Sir, I want to thank you so much for your call. I really appreciate it, and I wanted to tell you that I appreciate the hard work that you're doing for yourself and for the good people of Minnesota. Thanks so much for joining us, sir.
Thanks for having me on, Richard.
Rick? Rick? Steve Horn. Can you hear me? Rick? Hello? Hello, Rick?
I'm in school today, dear. What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? I learned that Washington never told a lie. I learned that soldiers seldom...